I'm sorry, Mr. Cruz.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Do you have an update for us today on it?
I've spoken to Ms. Kwan's grandson, who confirmed that she did pass away about 2 weeks ago. He said there were some documents executed before her death. His understanding is his mother and Mrs. Kwan's daughter, Helen Kwan, is handling the estate's affairs. I don't have any other details than that. I wasn't informed until yesterday that she had passed away. But when we did learn of it, we took immediate action to figure out what to do about it in terms of correcting the record, what we need to do with this court, and finding out what happened. Because apparently the lawyer wasn't the first person they called when she passed, and I hadn't otherwise been in touch with her since shortly after trial. Or I should say, rather, around the time the appeal was filed.
So where does that leave us?
Well, my understanding from Mr. Lee is that the estate intends to pursue the appeal.
So the estate will be substituted for your client?
That is my understanding of the intent, Your Honor, yes.
Then let's proceed then.
May it please the Court, my name is Mike Cruz. As you know, I'm here for Daekon Kwan, the plaintiff in the underlying case and the appellant here. This case was decided ultimately placing 30% fault with the defendant, Costco, 70% fault with the plaintiff, Ms. Kwan. Under Hawaii law, then there's no recovery. She must prove that the defendant was over 50% at fault. And the appeal was filed because that conclusion was reached based upon two clear errors of law, an additional error in failing to enforce a pretrial sanctions order requiring an adverse inference of a certain set of facts that would have appeared on a surveillance video had it not been destroyed and, as the court found, spoiled, which culminated in an ultimate contaminated analysis of the comparison of fault between Ms. Kwan and Costco, which was then augmented by the fact that there were no specific findings that Ms. Kwan didn't exercise due care in any way. Now, turning first to those errors of law, the first was a misapplication of the duty to warn. The duty to warn arises upon notice, or notice is also comes in the form of creation of an unreasonable risk of harm. The court's analysis was that the duty of harm arises when the defendant, or the defendant's agent, employee in this case, has noticed that the plaintiff, the person who's about to be injured, doesn't see the risk of harm.
Well, did the district court determine that an unreasonable hazard existed?
It did, Your Honor. It made a few specific findings in that regard, and it's confirmed with its ultimate finding.
Where is that in the record?
Well, at page 6 of the findings of fact, which appears on page 41 of the excerpts of record, there's the conclusion that Costco and its employees know that flatbed carts used by Costco present potential tripping hazards. Then later on at page 19, it lists 6 specific ways, and it should be 7 if it included the failure to warn, in which the defendant, either through its affirmative acts or omissions, made that risk of harm more dangerous. That's by definition an unreasonable risk of harm.
The district court never said, because of this, this, and this, I find that there was an unreasonable hazard that existed. Did it? Did the district court do that?
The district court didn't state that exact sentence.
Right.
But by acknowledging a risk of harm of tripping, okay, and it says by itself, sitting off, I guess, in a totally illuminated place on its own is not a hazard. But it found affirmatively, and these are the findings on page 19, that it took that risk of harm and increased it, which is by definition an unreasonable risk of harm. outside under lights or against the wall, it may not present a risk of harm. But in the context and the facts of this case, where it takes the flatbed carts and stacks five of them together, which the court acknowledged increases the risk of harm, it brings the cart into a crowded aisleway during the busiest time of the day, and it doesn't paint them to keep them visible, all affirmatively increase that risk of harm, and by definition is a reasonable, unreasonable risk of harm. And I know that the defendant and the appellee here makes a lot of argument about there is no unreasonable risk of harm. We have an ultimate conclusion that Costco is 30% at fault. That requires that the court found that there was an unreasonable risk of harm, that there was negligence in affirmatively creating that risk of harm or in failing to remove it, and that that was a substantial cause of the injury. It just lowered it to 70%, which is part of our second problem with the analysis on the overall standard of unreasonable risk of harm. One, it's diluted because they're not looking at the failure to warn, but the court goes through this analysis and says, we have a risk of harm.
Well, it really, if you look at page 18 of the district court's finding, at number 10, you go through 10, 11, 12, 13, all of those findings, there's a mixture of things that the court found, including that they did not there's no evidence that a single flatbed cart constitutes an unreasonable hazard. There is no credible evidence, and the court does not find that a stationary row of five flatbed carts is without more an unreasonable hazard. That's at number 12. I guess there's just a combination of things. So there was never a definitive statement that the district court found an unreasonable risk of harm. Is that correct? And so I'm just trying to find out about what the duty to warn then would be if there was no clear finding by the district court.
No, you're correct that the court does make some conflicting findings. And our argument is based on looking at those specific findings and how under a proper understanding of unreasonable risk of harm, and then thus duty to warn, there is in fact a finding of unreasonable risk of harm, and I think those paragraphs bear that out, where we have the court recognizing flatbed carts present a tripping hazard, but on their own, quote, to quote the court, don't present an unreasonable risk of harm.
Well, if they're not moving, they don't. But if they're moving, they might be. Now, in this case, it seems to me the controlling question is, were the carts moving at the time the deceased, now the plaintiff, encountered the carts with her leg or foot and fell? If the carts, of course, if the evidence hadn't been spoiled by being erased after 6 days or whatever they do with their film, if the evidence hadn't been spoiled, we might know whether the carts were moving. And if the carts were moving, then the judge may have been wrong when he said she was 70% negligent for failing to keep a lookout. But Costco was 30% negligent for having a hazardous condition. So if there was a new trial, what would you do about the presumption, I guess, that goes with spoliation of evidence? How would you would argue that because there's no proof as to whether the carts were moving, there's no believable proof as to whether the carts were moving or not, and we don't have the film because it was spoiled, how do you put together a new case on retrial?
Well, that was the same as our argument at trial, and it would be the same at retrial. There was evidence that the carts were moving. Well, first of all, I agree, and the answer kind of has two parts, but first, looking at the spoliation issue, that was why we filed the motion, was on that point. If we had had this, and the court affirmatively found this was spoliation,
yeah,
and we are imposing wasn't as a, you know.
And then he inconveniently forgot about that finding after he got to making his final decision.
Exactly. And that is why we filed the motion, said if we had this video, we'd be able to see what happened. We don't have the video. They spoiled it. So those facts, the scope of which are not in controversy, it would have included where the incident occurred.
What law requires the court to apply an adverse inference in any particular way? Because he did use it to say that, okay, I'll say that the Costco was very crowded, and I'm just trying to figure out what, is there any a law that dictates how a district court should apply an adverse inference?
Our argument certainly is not there's no discretion in how that would be applied, and I'm sure that there could be cases where that boundary between you're applying it or not is more is subject to more close scrutiny. And here, in this case, I believe you look at every material fact, at least with respect to whether it was moving or not, and those were inferred the opposite, in favor of Costco. So I think it's safe to say that if you are going to infer the facts subject to an adverse inference favorably to the party who's been found to be the despoiler of evidence, that's not an adverse inference. And that's what we have, particularly with Mr. Ogasawara, who was the co-employee of the woman who was moving the carts, or at least holding the carts, where he looked up and his initial testimony at trial was, no, I looked up, didn't look like they were moving, I looked down, and then Mrs. Kwan was injured. His testimony at first seemed to have some inconsistencies, so on cross-examination, or actually it was redirect examination by myself, I explored some of the specifics of his testimony, and he spontaneously said, oh, no, the carts were moving. Okay, well, their witness has now said the cart is moving, so that was the end. The court, however, inquired further and asked a series of direct questions to Mr. Ogasawara, saying, you know, you've now confused me. You seem to have testified that it wasn't moving. Now you said it is moving. And Mr. Ogasawara confirmed multiple times to the court that the cart was certainly moving when he looked up, before he looked back down, which was a couple seconds before the fall.
That's a credibility determination made by the district court. Are we not to give that a lot of deference?
A credibility determination by the court in the ordinary course would certainly deserve more deference than it does here, where we have a specific set of facts that would have been appeared on the video, and the court said those were spoiled. And all the inferences we are going to draw adverse inferences to Costco on that set of facts, which includes whether the cart was moving. And when Costco's witness says, yes, the cart was moving, and the court says, well, we're going to just throw that out, that is in contravention of the adverse inference order that was imposed before trial, because it is inferring those facts in Costco's favor.
Well, now, what was the adverse inference order before trial? What did that require and show and hold?
The issue was Costco policy and the associated law of having to retain surveillance videos. We filed a motion because the evidence showed that they had this policy, they knew they were supposed to keep the video for exactly these purposes, and they didn't keep it.
And?
The court determined that's spoliation.
Right.
We're not going to enter default. But we are going to enter the remedy, and it used the term sanction, is going to order the particular sanction that at trial an adverse inference will be applied to these facts that would have appeared on the video.
Yeah, that's true, but how do we know that that wasn't done? Because it seems to me, as has been indicated, the key question in this case is whether the carts were moving. Madamba, who seems to have been in charge of the carts, said no, they weren't, and he specifically credits her testimony. That doesn't necessarily mean that he wasn't aware of this negative inference that you previously had set up. I mean, he heard everything. He said before the trial, I'm going to apply this inference, but then he concludes her testimony is credible. The carts were stationary. I mean, I can't conclude from this record that all of a sudden the inference from the spoliation thing just evaporated.
Well, I think by the result we have to.
I don't think that's – why? I mean, he credited Madamba. You can have an adverse inference from the spoliation thing, but you listen to this witness. He says that that witness testified credibly. I find that as a fact that they were stationary. Seems to me to be bulletproof, and I can't just assume that the any adverse inference went away. It's only an adverse inference. It's not a conclusive inference in this case. He didn't, in other words, he didn't find as a result of the spoliation, I'm going to find that the carts were moving.
No, that's true.
Instead, he took testimony and came to the conclusion the carts were stationary.
And if he were going to look at the evidence, or the court were going to look at the evidence and say, you know what, I don't think the adverse inference requires that those inferences be made on such facts as this, whether the cart was moving, whether Ms. Madamba's testimony is credible or not, and the weight to put in Mr. Ogasawara's testimony are all subject to this adverse inference order. Now, certainly the court could have, at trial, said, I've heard the testimony. I think the application of the adverse inference order would be unjust. I'm revisiting that order. I'm adjusting it. I'm lifting
unjust,
it.
Not unjust. I've drawn the inferences, but they're just inferences. And here we've got direct testimony that says they were stationary. He has decided to believe that. That's what a trial is all about.
Absolutely. And this trial took place with these certain facts.
Well, did you say to the judge, what about the adverse inference, when all of these rulings came down about Madame and everybody else and her credibility?
They were certainly addressed in our proposed findings and conclusions, and after the conclusions.
So it was right there in front of them, the adverse inference from the spoliation.
Yes.
And so now, how do we know that he wasn't paying any attention when it was right in the documents that you presented to him?
I don't know whether he was paying attention to it or not, but it wasn't applied.
Well, I don't know how you can say that, because judges do an awful lot of things, and they don't just, you know, go through the process like a kabuki dance of saying, I've done this, I've done that. I mean, if you make an argument and then you lose, I don't say you can lawyers say this all the time. They ignored my argument. I just don't know how we can say that when it was right smack staring the judge in his face.
And I'm not arguing that he wasn't aware of it. I'm saying we look at the record and it wasn't applied because these were the facts that were subject to the adverse inference.
Adverse inference doesn't mean that you win.
No, I understand.
It goes into the whole pot of stew that's made up by all the witnesses' testimony. At the end of that, he made a finding that the thing was stationary, and he credits Madamba, who seems to have been in charge of the whole cart thing.
She was the one who was handling the cart.
Right.
That's true.
And she says they were stationary, and he said, I find that credible. I don't have any problem at all in understanding how that could overwhelm any adverse inference from the failure to keep the tapes.
In which case, the adverse inference would have needed to have been set aside, which is where we get the test.
Did you make a motion for new trial on the ground that the spoliation adverse inference wasn't applied to these facts and circumstances?
No, we presented it as an issue on appeal because it had been briefed. The court, our understanding was not that the court wasn't aware of it. It was that the court didn't apply it. And when we have a witness like Ms. Madamba who's testified about three things, two of which have been proven objectively untrue, and then the court accepts her testimony about whether the carts were moving or not, in spite of evidence by her coworker that the carts were moving, the adverse inference was in play.
Well, if
it wasn't applied.
If there's a practice pointer here, it might be to make a motion for a new trial on that ground.
Noted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Richard Cowan, appearing on behalf of defendant.
Thank you.
Costco Wholesale Corporation. With respect to the video, Costco screwed up. They were supposed to maintain the video. They didn't. The court entertained Mr. Cruz's motion and entered the adverse inference.
At first I thought you said counsel screwed up, but Costco screwed up.
Costco, okay. I'm sorry. Not Mr. Cruz. The court, I think, Judge, as you mentioned, the court is not bound on a conclusive basis to stick to the adverse inference that it found. If we go back to What the video would have shown, we don't know. There was evidence that the camera is focused, but we don't know it was focused on the site of the incident. Be that as it may, the court made the adverse inference, and with respect to the movement, non-movement, the judge weighed the credibility of Ms. Badama and the other trial witnesses and made the finding that the carts were stationary.
And your argument would be notwithstanding the inference made that finding.
That is correct, Your Honor. And the judge clearly had in his mind at least one of the three adverse inferences. At paragraph 18, he specifically refers to 18, which is on page 7, excerpt volume 1, page 7. On the date of the incident, a constant flow of customers was entering the exit aisle. The court infers adversely to Costco that the aisle was very crowded at the time of the incident. I'll omit reading the footnote. Now, that doesn't go to the point of the movement of the carts, but clearly the judge was aware that there were adverse inferences out there. And couple that with a finding that the carts were stationary, I think leads me to the conclusion that the judge was aware of the adverse inferences and chose not to apply it.
What was the time interval between the discussion about adverse inferences from the spoliation and the trial itself?
The order granting Mr. Cruz's motion in part was February 17th. The trial took place days later.
So it's not like a year later.
Oh, no, Your Honor. The trial in this case, I believe, was the 19th, something in the 20s for 2 days, and then March 4th was the third day of trial. So it was within 2 to 3 weeks of the hearing on the adverse inference. Well, I shouldn't say it, Judge. The order. Let me find out when the hearing. The February 19th date, Judge, the 17th date, was the date on which the court signed the order. I do not have the date before me on which the argument was made. But clearly on the 17th. He was looking at it.
Was it improper for the district court to consider the lack of past accidents in determining whether there was a risk of harm or an unreasonable risk of harm?
Judge, I did not hear the first part.
Was it proper for the court, the district court, to consider the lack of past accidents? I thought that was an issue that was raised with respect to that.
I think it was raised at one point, Your Honor. I don't think it was one of the issues that the appellant raised on appeal.
Was it proper for the district court to consider the past accidents?
I think so, Your Honor. Maybe in an indirect way. In that, what is the risk posed by these carts? This Costco warehouse is the busiest Costco warehouse in the country. They have, I think it was 1.6 million people coming, members, these doesn't count guests of members, walking through those doors every year. And there are two modes of transporting, well, three, you can hand carry your purchases. They have a regular grocery cart vehicle. Then they have these flatbeds, which are 17 feet long, 3.5 feet high at the handle in the back. The flatbed portion of it is ankle height, no doubt about it. And the rim, in the best of all worlds, is painted a bright orange around the flatbed portion, up the vertical parts that support the push handle, which is horizontal. Now, there was a lot of talk about the paint chipping. Yes, the paint was chipped. It's still orange. I mean, it didn't blend into a gray-brown concrete floor. And if you stack five of these things together, you're talking about a rather large set of flatbeds. I would suggest to you maybe the size, the length of the clerk's table in front of you. Now, the law before Stegman, which came out in December of last year, was open and obvious is a defense. If it's open and obvious, there's no duty to warn. Here, our position is that this size of a stack of five flatbed carts, painted in part in orange, was open and obvious. Therefore, the first argument on no duty to warn is just that, it's open and obvious. There is testimony at trial that Ms. Kwan walked within an arm's length or two to the right of this length of flatbed carts, saw her daughter diagonally to her left near the hearing aid center, and turned and to walk towards her, and she tripped. The law in Hawaii is clear that a pedestrian must be aware of his or her surroundings. She testified, and I believe it's in the findings, that she was walking and she was looking down. Well, as she walked up to make her diagonal turn, looking down, there's the front edge of the leading flatbed. I think Stegman may change that, but it was post-briefing December of last year, so I don't think it applies. Although it's interesting to note that the...
So what's the point you're trying to make?
Your Honor, that it was... Thank you. Yeah, open and obvious, no duty to warn. Getting back for a moment,
what's the 30% all about?
Your Honor, the 30% is that we did it, Costco did it, very crowded part of the day, that stacking the flatbeds was probably against, well, Costco's policy said you shouldn't stack, but if you do, you got to be able to handle the stack that you're moving. Madamba testified that the five carts was more than she had normally stacked and may even have testified it was more than she'd ever stacked before, and that in order to get going, she had to lean, step backward, put her weight against the trailing horizontal bar, and push, because these things are heavy. So I think that that, coupled with the painting, chipping issue, gave rise to the imposition of the contributory negligence on the part of Costco.
But that in and of itself doesn't create a duty to warn.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because you have this open and obvious situation in front of you. And in fact, Judge Seabright found a side note, if I may, Your Honor. Mrs. Kwan herself testified that people were not blocking her travel as she moved toward the hearing center where her daughter was prior to the incident. Finding 42 on page 13, the court finds it more likely than not that plaintiff came into contact with the subject flatbeds because she failed to notice them rather than because of any action or inaction on the part of a Costco employee. So it's, did Costco, aside from the spoliation issue of the video, did Costco do everything right here? No, it didn't. Shouldn't have been out there in the lunch hour. Shouldn't have stacked five flatbeds. Should it, in the best of all worlds, have another employee at the forefront of the stack of carts, basically clearing the way for the stack?
Keep going. You're making a good case for that.
Mr. Cruz and I have talked about these ad nauseum, Your Honor. It's the woulda, coulda, shoulda.
What you're saying is we're in appellate court.
Correct, Your Honor.
You have findings of fact and credibility that are bulletproof.
And I suggest to you that the majority of the issues outside of the pure legal issues on the case law that Mr. Cruz raises is just that. Judge Seabright saw the witnesses, got a feel for them, made his findings based on that. Adopting some and rejecting some of the proposed findings that both Mr. Cruz and I submitted. And he judged the credibility of these witnesses, and I respectfully suggest that you're stuck with them on the credibility issue. On the first issue of appeal, Mr. Cruz raises, did the trial court err in refusing to apply the spoliation findings? I've addressed that. The court didn't err because he specifically referenced one and had the order with respect to the motion in limine before him within a matter of weeks before trial. Number two, did the district court err when he found duty to warn did not arise unless and until defendant has notice that the plaintiff did not see the tripping hazard. I believe I've addressed that. The tripping hazard, she walked right next to it. It was open and obvious. The third point is that the district court erred in applying the degree of dangerousness versus the unreasonable risk of harm. I believe that's incorrect, Your Honor. Conclusion of law number 10, plaintiff failed to prove by a preponderance that the flatbeds presented an unreasonable risk of harm. He had that in his mind and made that conclusion. And the fourth one goes to the comparative negligence. I suggest that the court has broad discretion in arriving based on the evidence as a whole as to the culpability of both parties. Finding of fact number 42 basically says the plaintiff came into contact with the flatbeds because she failed to notice them rather than any action or interaction by Costco. And conclusion of law number 18, despite the increased risk created by Costco, Costco presented by preponderance of the evidence that plaintiff failed to exercise the amount of care that would be expected of a person of ordinary prudence in the same circumstances. Mrs. Kwan failed to see and avoid, this is conclusion number 21, Your Honors, even though she could clearly see her path of travel, which was a specific finding of fact, and had substantial, what the court said is, visual clues alerting her to the subject flatbeds, the size, the orange, walking her proximity to it. So, Your Honor, with that, I suggest that although not perfect, I believe that the findings of fact, conclusion of law, and the subsequent judgment were correct. I ask the court to affirm them, and I thank you for your time and your patience.
Thank you. Have a minute to respond if you want.
Okay. I think Judge Trout's question about what about the 30% is kind of at the bottom of the inherent contradictions in the findings and conclusions. The court mentions over and again there's no unreasonable risk of harm here. But in order to find that Costco was 30% at fault, it had to have found that there was an unreasonable risk of harm, that there was negligence. It's just on the balancing of the negligence, it only apportioned 30% to Costco, 70% to Mrs. Kwan.
Let me go to something else. Counsel read to us from the record something that suggests that the court was aware of the adverse inference and imposed it.
That's
concluding
correct.
That it, so it seems to me that from that I can assume that my surmise is correct, that the court was aware of it, imposed it where they thought it was important and found that the place was crowded, but then that was overtaken by the testimony of the witnesses. So, I mean, the court said adverse inference.
The court was aware of it, and it applied it to an uncontroverted fact. All the facts were that the hall was crowded. So there's no adverse inference there. That's an uncontroverted fact. Where the facts were controverted, and there was actually a question, a material question to be decided, it went with Costco on every single one of those, in spite of the adverse inference. But the overall analysis, and this goes to the duty to warn, which was totally discarded.
Did you argue the adverse inference to the court before it made its findings of fact and conclusions of law?
Yes. I'm not arguing that the court wasn't aware of it. My argument is that it wasn't applied where it should have been applied. But setting that aside, the duty to warn was discarded, which is an entire claim on its own. If we have the court apportioning 30% negligence to Costco, it has found there's an unreasonable risk of harm, which would give rise to the duty to warn. That's the case law cited by everybody. But the court nonetheless discarded it. That impacted not just the duty to warn, but the overall analysis of unreasonable risk of harm, which the court has found, and then it appears to have tempered by making determinations that had nothing to do with the facts of the case. Like in other circumstances on other days, there haven't been any other instances, or they don't have a bad, or there were some instances, but they don't have a bad history of people tripping over these things. But those are in factual contexts that have nothing to do with the facts of this case, which was at a particular time of day, in a particularly busy hour, with particular carts, with the paint chipping off.
What was the extent of the damages that your client suffered?
She broke her arm, had to have surgery to that, and busted out some teeth.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments here today. We'll take these matters under advisement. This case under advisement. Thank you very much. You are excused.
Thank you.